Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Icelandic Roots podcast. Today we interviewed Kent Lauris Bjarnason, who is a Western Icelander born and raised in Gimli, Manitoba, but today resides in Reykjavik, where he works there locally at a school. But Kent is also a private tour consultant, guide, and driver, very creative and versatile in his work that he does as a guide and generally as a wealth of information on all things relating to Icelandic history, but also, of course, Western Icelandic history and how that all fits together. Kent has been a dual citizen since 2008. And, as Kent is such a world traveler, we also talk about trips that he's made to other interesting parts of the world. So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and stay tuned for more just like this. If we maybe wanted to start off with talking about you in Iceland currently, and maybe current things going on in Iceland, and maybe as it pertains to tourism.
Should we start off like current, or a little bit about my history? Because like I came here in 1979.
I was gonna say, yeah, we could go right back to your origin story. Honestly, I think it's really cool how you started and graduated same high school as me, and now you're right across the ocean doing some really cool things in Iceland. So yeah, if you just want to tell us a bit about your story, we can certainly start there.
Well, like in the mid 70s, there was lots of charter flights and Icelanders going to Canada and the United States, and lots of Canadians coming to Iceland. And my whole family came here. Like that started kind of in the 70s, 73, 74. There were some big festivals here. 79, my whole family came to Iceland except for me. I stayed back. That was the year I graduated from Gimli High School. And I decided that I was going to go and stay longer. So my whole family came and left me in charge of the family business. And then I came here in September of 1979. So I was kind of on my own, but I had some contacts here and had met some people. I had kind of a job lined up if I needed it. And so I started off in a knitting factory in Blundos. That was my first job.
Wow, yeah, that's a bit more of a rural experience even as the first one.
Yeah, well, yeah, and not too, like, you know, in those days, not many people spoke English, like especially out in the countryside.
Yeah,
and there was the guy who hired me. He had been an exchange student in the U.S., so he spoke perfect English. He was the manager of the knitting factory. I had no work permit, no nothing. Like, I guess maybe I should watch what I'm saying, but I think that's a long time ago. So they, can't take away, they can't make me pay for something I did 40 years ago.
Coming across from Gimli, like how much Icelandic influence and language did you have before going there?
Well, I had, I just had the basic words, Amalavi, Golanot, but there was a lot of Icelandic spoken around me. So it wasn't as foreign as, some other languages and stuff. But I wouldn't say I knew any Icelandic when I came here. Like it was just basic stuff. And so I spent like half a year in Blundos, and then the second half of the year, the next spring, I was in Grindavik, in a fish processing plant in Grindavik. That was my first year. I went back to Canada for a year, registered for university, and moved into an apartment on Pembina Highway, and hated Winnipeg.
Can't blame you for that.
It was just such a culture shock going from small town in Manitoba, Fraserwood, or even Gimli, going to Blundos and Grindavik, and going to a big city like Winnipeg. So it was just kind of a culture shock. And
yeah,
so I said, I'm going back to Iceland. And my mother talked me into finishing my first year at the U of M. And then I came back and spent another year here in Iceland. And then I worked in a fish processing plant in Djúpavogur. And on a fishing boat from Hub in Hornafjörður. So I was
a
fisherman, a deckhand.
You really got around the island in those early job experiences.
Yeah. I don't regret it. And so then I came back to Iceland every 2-3 years for holiday. Mm-hmm. And then 2000, they were advertising a job at the soon-to-be-open Canadian Embassy.
Hmm.
My cousin here sent me the ad out of Morgenblatt. I applied for it. I didn't get it. I had an interview, but I didn't get it. But that's what kind of got me thinking about going back to Iceland in 2000. And Svavar Gestsson was the consul in Winnipeg, and I knew he had been a cabinet minister and stuff, and I didn't know he was the cabinet minister, culture and the school mentor. My English is getting bad.
Speaking too much Icelandic.
Yeah.
Hey, that's never a bad problem.
So he helped me get this job at MHAL, at Mental School of Hammersley. I was came back. I was going to only spend a couple of years here.
Mm.
And 22 years later, I'm still here.
But, yeah, that's some good insight, too, that you applied for a job or maybe two different ones and before finding one. Because I know recently they had the working holiday for youth up to 35, a webinar about that.
Yeah, they just announced it, yeah.
You know, it can sometimes seem overwhelming thinking about trying to get a job in a different country. And it's a good example that, you know, you may apply for one thing, not get that, but you got to keep trying and try to make connections like what you did. And
well, the good thing about the new one is that you don't really need it. See, technically, if you want to get a work permit and stuff, you have to do it from abroad.
Right.
But with that youth one, you get a work permit and you can come here and work one place, no problem, and you know, find something better or something else that you want to do. And, you know, whereas the normal way for that it used to be is the work had to kind of hire you, and they could kind of hold you to the term, sort of thing, you know. So it's a big change for the better.
Yes, certainly.
And that way, you know, you're not losing out by, you know, not staying the whole time at one place. You know, I just wish they had something like that when I was goofing around here 40 years ago.
Yeah, there definitely seems to be some more structure, but maybe people like you and doing what you did kind of set that groundwork, right?
Well, they've been talking about it for a long time. Nothing new, and they have the same program for the United States and other countries. Something slow in Canada and Iceland.
Yeah, interesting.
That new visa is, I think I've had it open on a tab in my computer for the past 3 weeks, just thinking and thinking and thinking on it.
Well, and like that's the thing is, you know, especially with airfares going up and so much, it's so much better to have the visa ahead of time.
Exactly.
And instead of coming here and finding a job and having to leave for 6 months while the visa is being processed.
Oh, absolutely. Just in terms of that, I know it's not the exact same, but I applied for my Nexus in June of 2023. Mm-hmm. And I just got an inquiry back last week, and I still am 16 months out.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
Nexus, that's the...
Yeah, that's the Canadian-American one that they just kind of verify that you're not a terrorist risk and get you through security a little faster.
Yeah, I don't think I can even apply for it because I'm not a resident of Canada.
Ah.
Oh, yeah, that might be.
I have citizenship, but...
But maybe just that mention is a good jumping off point to maybe talk about how you got citizenship in Iceland.
That was the thing is, like, even though I'm 100% of Icelandic descent...
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a lot more Icelandic than most Icelanders are, even because there's no mixture in my blood, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I had to apply as a foreigner, a total non-European foreigner. So I could only get a 1 year work permit, and it took I don't know how many months. I actually came before I wasn't supposed to come before the work permit was issued, but they weren't quite as strict 20 years ago either. Like I came and I didn't get paid right away. I did get my work permit finally, and so I went through the process of 1 year work permit for three times. After 3 years, you could apply for permanent residency, kind of like the American green card sort of thing. So I applied for that, and basically you could continue on. I have lots of friends that just have the permanent residency because they didn't honor dual citizenship with Canada.
Oh.
At the time. That changed in 2008.
Okay.
And I wouldn't have given up my Canadian citizenship.
Yeah, right.
Because really the only thing I couldn't do was vote for parliament and vote for the president.
Mm-hmm.
I could vote for civic, you know, for mayor, and I could vote for city councilors. I could vote for, you know, I could do everything as an Icelander, except vote for parliament and the president.
Huh. Interesting. So federal was kind of like the line drawn in the sand, so to speak.
But then that law changed in 2008, so I could apply for dual citizenship, or could apply for my Icelandic citizenship. It took over a year to get it, but it didn't really. I still had my permanent residence, so.
Yeah,
and the thing with permanent residence is, you can't really leave. You know, you can't decide to leave and go back to Canada for a couple of years,
right?
And keep your permanent residence, unless my work sent me to Canada to study or to work.
Okay.
So you know, I wasn't planning on moving back to Canada right away, anyways. But that's one difference with citizenship. But it's just so much nicer to have a European passport. Like it's
right. And then when traveling to other European countries, of course, you don't fall into the, you know, 90-day Schengen zone and that sort of
thing. Yeah, no, nothing. Like I could move to any European country right. tomorrow.
And wow.
Yeah, that's cool.
With the Icelandic passport. But then that's same with the Canadian passport in the United States. It's so much nicer to have a Canadian passport. For entering.
Yeah, I guess it just depends on the destination you're going as where you want to tell them you're from, right?
Yeah, I know where what the lineup's like.
Yeah, exactly.
But then I need to have a valid Canadian passport to go to Canada.
Oh, interesting. Right.
It can't be expired. I can't use my Icelandic.
Hmm.
They could turn me around at the airport in Iceland.
Interesting. So you've always got to make sure that's right up to date, otherwise
yeah.
there'd be problems.
Yeah, traveling to Canada as a Canadian. I can't travel there as an Icelander. One time, because you don't get stamps in passports anymore. So one time I said, I live in Iceland. And he says, well, do you have an Icelandic passport? I said, yes. Can I use my Icelandic passport? Then I would have gotten a stamp in the passport. He says, no, you're a Canadian. Use your Canadian passport.
he didn't want none of that mixing.
They're really strict with that now. I've heard of some people turn it around.
Oh yeah, I know. Even myself, flying back from the Snorri trip, my mom's maiden name, the Gudbjørnsen, was marked as my middle name on the ticket board. And flying into Iceland, they were super lenient. They didn't care. They were like, ah, yeah, good enough. I'm sure it's a maiden name, last name ending in Sun. You're fine. But when I flew back to Canada. That was when they were like, no, you got to edit that here, pay the $30 for the name switch and make sure you're good. Otherwise, they'll flag you and give you difficulties.
Because Iceland is such an important spot for European travelers and stuff.
Yeah.
They're a lot stricter. England can be pretty strict sometimes, too.
And then another question I had for you. So you were talking about these jobs that kind of fish processing. I would love to hear kind of the transition from moving towards those kinds of jobs, more labor-based. You do a lot more tourism-based stuff now. So how did that switch kind of come afoot?
Like I was a truck driver in Canada. I drove lots in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba. So then I went from driving lots to driving nothing. And then I decided to take the tour guiding school. I thought that would be interesting. So like a couple of years after I came here, I took the tour guiding school and I met up some people. Well, I got my license right away too.
Hmm.
Like at that time, I just gave them my Manitoba license. I got an Icelandic one back. And I could drive everything. I couldn't take paying passengers.
Oh, okay.
I had to take a course. I had to take a course here, passenger safety or something like that. And so I couldn't take paying passengers. So I got my license right away here. They call it Metaprof, like kind of a can drive everything sort of thing, big trucks. And,
oh, yeah. Yeah, kind of like the equivalent of a class one
yeah,
here.
Yeah, I got that right away. And one of my friends, he says, well, they're looking for people to drive straight, though, on weekends and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So I started driving transit bus on the weekends. And it was just kind of something to do different and made very little money. You know, like the pay isn't very good and stuff. So it kind of went from that into more tour buses and so now, like, and then I finished the tour guiding school. So, Sometimes I'm a tour guide, sometimes I'm a bus driver, sometimes I'm both.
Depends on the vehicle, I guess.
Depends on the size of the group and yeah, so.
Yeah, well, you were both for us when we were on the Snorri program 2 years ago, and so that was lots of fun.
Yep.
Yeah, with the smaller groups, you can have up to 18 people on a bus sort of thing, be a driver guide, and kind of just develop that. And some summers I've worked, like when I first started doing it, I worked lots all summer. Like I had no days off and went, I don't know how many times, I think the most I went 5 times around Iceland one summer.
Wow, in one summer.
Yeah, that's a couple trips around the ring road.
But that was mainly just as a bus driver.
Okay.
I guess I did the Snorri group too, but for the most part, it was more just a bus driver and stuff. And when I did a lot of the circle tours.
Okay.
And now I'm kind of getting lazier, getting old and lazy. So I kind of gear towards smaller groups, families, and, groups like the Snorris or, and I just bought a 9-passenger van. So I'm going to, I can take up to 8 passengers.
Oh, awesome. Very cool.
And that's the size of group I like, small groups.
Right. You can get more intimate in that sort of thing. What would be like a favorite tour that you would do? Do you like the Golden Circle, the touristy stuff, or would you like to go to other places?
No, I kind of avoid the Golden Circle.
That's probably wise.
I can do it. I've done it a few times, but I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't want to do it 5 times a week.
Yeah.
and what I do, like especially during the school year and stuff, I'm only really available on weekends. Mm. So what I tell people is that if they want to do the Golden Circle and stuff, they can get another tour company or a small group company during the week, and then we can go exploring on weekends.
Yeah.
And going to places that aren't the normal. Because I can't really compete with the prices for the Golden Circle. There's just so many companies doing it and stuff, It doesn't pay, people who have the money and want to pay the extra and stuff, they can hire me. It's not like, if I'm available. Mm-hmm. But I prefer, going to, I haven't done the West Fjords for a while. Now I'm doing it 4 times this summer.
Well, there you go.
The Snorri group is going and the.
Okay, you're doing Snorri again this year then.
Yeah, I have a couple of other groups, kind of small groups and stuff that is going. And then now I might not do it again for another couple of years, so you never know for sure.
That's a good balance. That's a place I have yet to go to. How about you, Owen? Did you make it out to the West Fjords?
No, not really. But I am hopeful. I think we're going to try and go up to Patrick's Fjord here in July when we come out.
Yeah, you have family there, don't you? Or like here.
Yes, yeah, exactly. That's kind of the homestead area is Patrick's Fjord there. So I figure I better do my Umma proud and make it up there this time around and go see the homestead.
Mm-hmm. Based on your experience with tour groups and that sort of thing, do you ever have any, I don't know if bad experiences is the right word, or just some questionable or funny experiences doing tour guides around Iceland?
Well, because now I've never really had any real problem people and stuff. There is a few people here and there sometimes that expect a little bit much and, but
high maintenance.
High maintenance and stuff. But thank goodness I haven't really had any accidents and stuff, because there is, people are. Things happen, like heart attacks and this and that.
There was a last year when I was with Icelandic Roots doing that tour, quite close to the end of our tour. It was, I think, 10 days maybe. I should know how many days it was. But all the travel last summer just blended into one. But we were quite close to coming back to Reykjavik, and we saw a bus very similar to ours being towed in the opposite direction. There was like these windows smashed in it, not too much damage, but you could tell like, oh, something happened to that. And I forget exactly, but there was a news article, and maybe you saw this too. It was like mid-September last year. And I don't know, maybe just high winds and something happened and the bus ran off under the ditch. I don't think anyone was injured, but it was a little bit, seeing that going the other way. And we're on a bus just like it was.
I went out to the East Coast or Southeast last weekend. Mm. with a group with a school choir, with the choir from my school that I worked at. And it was windy, and it was, I didn't see any major accidents or whatever, but, you know, the wind can take those big buses.
Yeah.
You know.
No kidding. I remember conversations about that when I was there as well. And it seems specifically like that southeast coast seems to get like the crazy.
Certain winds. Areas, like, you know, you're going along and all of a sudden blows, you know, and then it's fine again. And then, you know, it's kind of,
yeah.
It's not a steady wind, as you could.
Yeah, it comes in waves almost.
Yeah, it comes in waves.
I noticed that even with the waterfalls, actually, you'd be seeing them, and then every once in a while you get a gust and the waterfall disappears into steam and then it falls back down.
Yeah.
Something else I think on the roads, a lot of us, I think, have this thought is when you're first driving on them, you think they're very narrow and just kind of odd not seeing any sort of shoulders on the road. And I know, like, if you look online as a tourist, driving is always like rated as quite safe, you know, in the country, but I can't help but think that must throw a lot of people off. You know, there's no like areas to pull off on a shoulder, or it seems a little bit tight.
Well, it's a little bit tight. And then you get these tourists that stop in the middle of the road and take photos of horses and scenery and waterfalls from their highway. I don't know if they do that at home, but I don't think too many people would like it if you, even if the shoulder is there, like, you know, even with a shoulder, it's still not very smart to stop. And then one person stops and then another person stops because he says, oh, I'm going to do that too. And then all of a sudden, you're like,
oh yeah. And then it just builds up down the whole line and nobody moves.
Like there's some beats and bad accidents out there. You know,
so have you noticed more of that sort of thing? Like as tourism has increased over the last decade or longer, have you noticed more and more of these tourists and just maybe driving issues, not knowing what to do?
Well, because there's more and more people driving their own. You know, you know, 10, 15 years ago, most people coming here, they'd do a tour. They'd be on a tour bus and a full circle tour in 8 days, 8 to 9 days. But now you get all these yahoos driving, renting a car. Some of them don't know how to drive in the best of times. And then like the, you know, the conditions here in Iceland with the wind, with the snow, with the sand, you know, gravel roads and stuff like that. It's a lot different driving here. You know, even for people who know are good drivers at home, they're not always good drivers here. And then they stop on the road to take pictures of horses. You know.
Yeah, no, exactly. There's something to be said about learning how to drive in that area, right? Like I know, even same thing out in these Manitoba winters. Like, you know, every once in a while you can run into those drivers who it's like, oh, his car's stuck in the snow. You don't need to push it out. He just knows how to hit those ruts and drives and get it out. But that just comes from lived experience, and sometimes you just can't get that if you're from a totally different country.
Well, you've never seen snow before, or you've never seen, you know.
Yeah, on the topic of increased tourism, do you notice anything with the volcanic eruptions, like throughout this past winter? Do you see any sort of...
Well, I think people kind of got nervous about coming. Like because last year, I did a couple of tours, and like accommodations was totally booked up. A long time in advance, whereas now, I wouldn't. You know, there is more hotels opening and stuff too. So, yeah, there's still a lot of tourists coming.
Yep.
And, but it's not as booked up as it was for last summer. And because I was trying to find I had a couple friends from Minnesota coming. So I just needed like two rooms or whatever. There was nothing available from Selfoss all the way to Eskifjörður.
Holy moly!
So the one day I had to drive from Selfoss to Eskifjörður, which is quite a haul.
Yeah, even Selfoss is ways out of Reykjavik. Never mind. Going further.
It's just a little over an hour out of Reykjavik, so it's not, but it, there was just nothing. The only thing that was available, and I don't know, maybe it was a tent at the southeast corner, but I couldn't see my friend and her boyfriend share a tent with me.
Don't blame you for that one.
No, so that was the only thing that was, it was always available. Like sometimes things pop in, the cancellation. So, you know, if you keep your eye on booking.com, then you can maybe find a place, you know, but it was just nothing.
Wow.
But do you think this recent eruption is kind of scaring people off a little bit?
It scared a few people off, or, you know, kind of maybe they'll still come, but they're not booking as far in advance and stuff.
Well, if you don't really know people there and don't have a good grasp on the situation, just seeing the news articles and seeing how close these eruptions are to the airport and seeing the stuff with like the Blue Lagoon closing, which, I mean, that's quite a signal to tourists, right? I think they're all looking to go to the Blue Lagoon. So that kind of stuff I could see. It could make you second guess your travel plans.
Yeah, I would even say for the general crowd that I've noticed, like a lot of people know that I'm Icelandic, and the usual question I've been asked lately is like, oh, is everybody okay there? Like, what's going on? Is the country all right? And it's like, well, yes, it's one area. Like, it's not, the whole country isn't under lava here.
No, and it's just sad that the town had to be evacuated.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like at this point they're talking about, like, there's probably not going to be much of a return back there.
Not for a while, because they figure that this volcanic activity could last for years.
Yeah, I was reading.
The last volcano lasted for only about 8 hours or whatever. So,
yeah.
But it still covered up the main highway, so, with lava.
Have you seen any of this stuff within the last few months? Have you been in those areas?
No, it's all closed off. Like, you have special permission to go there. Except they did open the Blue Lagoon for a while there, and then they were expecting a volcano to erupt last weekend, like a week ago. A week ago. It never did. And now, so I don't even know if the Blue Lagoon's open again. But
I'd like to say that I feel bad for their business, but they make so much money, I'm sure they're covered for years in advance with profits.
Yeah. And they had to, like, they evacuated last Saturday, like a week, just over a week ago, and there was 800 people in the lagoon.
Holy moly. So they're not staying that far away, I guess.
I don't know. I'm not too excited about going to the Blue Lagoon myself.
That's kind of the persona I pick up from most Icelanders, I would say, at this point. It's usually like, yeah, it's cool, but usually steer clear because it's too chaotic.
Especially with this situation now.
Yeah, no kidding. There's plenty of other less volatile lagoons you could be going to these days.
Well, there's some nice ones now, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually just reading a copy of the Reykjavik Grapevine, and there was a big ad for Sky Lagoon in it for this month's issue, so I figured it must be something related to the Blue Lagoon closing. They want to capture that audience.
Have you felt any earthquakes over these last eruptions?
Not recently, no. It's not shaking and stuff like it was when Grindavik was first shaking apart there.
Yeah, I remember feeling them last year when I got there, the beginning of the summer. There was lots going on, lots of earthquakes in Reykjavik. So very interesting stuff. Do you have any other maybe tips, or, you know, if people are planning trips, tours, these sorts of things?
Well, like, there's so much online now, and like my biggest tip is, instead of jumping in a car and driving around the full circle in 6 days, to take an area. You know, take the west coast of Iceland and maybe the west fjords, or the north or the south. And if you're going to drive around the whole country in 6 days, you're not going to see anything except the highway, you know. And
which is still beautiful, but,
and there's so many people, well, I have to do the full circle. No, you don't have to do the full circle, you know. Like, it's better to, you know, do the south coast and maybe spend a night out in the south coast and come back to Reykjavik or close to Reykjavik, and then go up north, you know, or do the west, you know. Snæfellsnes, west. So everybody says, well, I'm only going to go there one time, and I kind of don't think that's going to happen. Like, if most people that I've talked to, even though they complain about it being expensive and stuff, you know, well, I'm coming back.
But there's Yeah, they sign up for it again and again, right? So this would probably be a good time as well, Kent, for yourself. If you wanted to drop any information about yourself, if anybody ever had tourist questions or was looking for a tour, if they wanted to get in contact with you.
Well, see, officially, Iceland is kind of complicated sometimes.
Okay.
I was trying to be all legal and stuff, and I decided, well, okay, I've got to operate it like a tour travel company. You have to have a special license and special insurance and this and that. And so I first got kind of a certificate saying I could be as a tour operator, which means a monthly tour. Then I thought, well, I want to do a little bit longer tours. And like, I also do tours to North America, and I do tours to Cuba too. So, I shouldn't say that. I've helped with tours, but to be a day tour operator, you're not supposed to book accommodations and stuff like that. So I kind of call myself kind of a consultant, a travel consultant, who has I have access to vehicles, like my own included, and I can drive people around. I can suggest what hotels they stay at. You know, and kind of recommend hotels and activities and stuff like that, but technically I can't book it. I could be your tour guide or like kind of a guide and a driver, but I can't.
Yeah,
I can't book hotels. So that what I do now, because I was a travel agency for a while, for a couple of years, it just got so complicated and I had to have a special bookkeeper. I had to have special insurance, and the insurance was pretty much for just doing a couple tours a year. If you're doing a couple tours a month, then it's worth it to have this insurance. But if you're only doing a couple tours over the summer and nothing in the fall and winter, then it was just kind of crazy. So I gave up my travel agency license, and then I went back to the tour operator license. So
okay.
So I class myself as kind of a tour consultant and or tour operator, like just driving and or guiding. If it's a big group, I can get a big bus and have a drive. Mm-hmm. Then you need a separate tour guide. Mm. I could be a tour guide and arrange for a bus driver with a bigger group to do a tour, a day, you know, a short tour.
Gotcha. Yeah. So yeah, not an agency, but a travel consultant.
Tour operator. Not for long tours or like that.
And also a wealth of knowledge, we can add. Owen and I can attest to.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, like we Iceland Roots has lots of information and lots of people I suggest to them to join Iconic Roots, even if it's just for the short term, look up their ancestry and find out information about them, their ancestors, and how they're related to different people and stuff like that. So, I have access to Iconic, Book of the Icelanders too, Icelandic Book.
Right.
But Iconic Roots is actually better for North Americans.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have a lot of the Icelandic Book doesn't have a lot of the information from North America.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't even, use it. I can look to see how I'm related to somebody else that's in the book, but I can't really use it for research and stuff like you can.
Right, like right now, and I had meant to do this before we logged on, like I can not only check our relations, Kent, but I could look up how you and Owen are related.
Yeah.
And just my suspicion being from Gimli that you guys would be much closer than I am.
Not necessarily.
Yeah. Well, it's true. There's always some surprises, isn't there?
Yeah.
That's true.
When did the genealogy understanding come to you? Like when you were younger and going to Iceland, did you have like family records that you knew?
My mother was kind of into genealogy and we got to meet some of the cousins and stuff, and But when I was younger, I wasn't really that interested in genealogy. I knew I was Icelandic, and I could find out how I was related to some of my cousins and stuff that I knew. But I wasn't really looking at other people or other, that wasn't until I, 20 years ago sort of thing, when I came back again and and things like Icelandic Roots are starting up. I got my access to Book of the Icelanders right away, but I wasn't even related to my great-grandparents.
Oh,
because it had
gaps.
It had none of the information. I had no relations whatsoever.
Oh, wow. Because you were born in North America.
And my parents were born in North America, and my grandparents were born in North America.
Yeah.
So I could find my great-grandparents that were in Iceland, or that were born in Iceland, but we weren't related. But then I took a course at the University of Iceland here. And my classmate of mine, she works at for Book of the Icelanders. And I said, well, how do you? Well, just send me the information. I'll put it in for you.
Yeah.
So one day I had no relatives, and now I'm related, like all four branches.
Related to everybody.
Now related to everybody.
And just like that, you're connected to the entire island again.
And then, like, for example, there was a teacher, kind of a special needs teacher, in the next office to my office at Adam Howe. And I said, I'm in the Book of the Icelanders. And, so you look to see how you're related. So she went in, put my name in, and here it turns out that my great-grandfather and her grandmother were brother and sister.
Oh, wow.
Oh, come on. That's a close one.
Yeah. And then it's not even that. It's even closer than that, because my great-grandfather, he lived with my Amanavi in Gimli.
Wow.
And that's the reason that my mother spoke such good Icelandic, was because you had to speak Icelandic with him. And then my other the cousin of mine here, her grandmother lived with them. So I'm not saying, you don't know your grandparents, but you don't maybe not living with them,
Exactly. Yeah, the stories that you can uncover for something like that.
Yeah, it's kind of that much closer,
Yeah.
So now we're close cousins, because she's even more closely related than the cousins that I've known for 40 years.
Wow.
And but that's just the way it is. We didn't know. She knew that, or her grandmother said that some of her family went to North America, and they actually settled in Saskatchewan, most of them.
Okay.
In Watnabeg,
Vineyard
and stuff. So it's a small world sometimes, and then
a big world other times.
Yeah, I find usually the closer connected you get to Iceland, the smaller the world becomes in so many senses.
Yeah, Kent, it might be worthwhile. I mean, we could talk about genealogy stuff all the time, as these podcasts often happen to, but unless you have anything more, any other stories to add on that, it might be worthwhile to wrap this up. Just as you mentioned, small world. Owen and I think are always impressed with how well traveled you are outside of Iceland. And maybe if there's any stories about recent trips, or I think you literally circumnavigated the globe not too long ago, right?
Well, I took a sabbatical last winter for 6 months. And how stupid was that, to go to Manitoba in the wintertime? The coldest winter that they've had for years.
I was going to say, and last winter was minus 55, I think, every day.
They should have came this winter. Much warmer.
Yeah, it was just crazy. You couldn't even go outside. So I was kind of, so that's why I went to Cuba a couple times. But then my biggest, I went to Cuba 3 times last winter. And twice from Winnipeg and once from Iceland. Took a group of school teachers and stuff to Cuba, and for Easter, like a year ago.
Okay.
And but then before that, I went around the world. I was looking at going, like, a cousin of mine who's from Edmonton, his parents are from Gimli in Manitoba originally, but he lived in Edmonton. He's been after me for a long time to go to the Philippines to visit him. So I decided I was going to go, and I started looking at airfare and stuff, and I thought, well, why not just go around the world? So that's what I did. I went to Florida with my brother. He's the marathon guru, so he was running in the Miami Marathon. And then I kept going. I went from Miami to Istanbul, Turkey to Mumbai, India, Mumbai to, I'm trying to remember now, Mumbai to Singapore, Singapore to the Philippines, Philippines to Taiwan, Taiwan to Korea, and then Korea back to Minneapolis and Winnipeg.
Wow.
And I did all that, and like, I don't know if I was just lucky or whatever, but like, I was very flexible, and I did that whole round the world, 35,000 kilometers for $3,000 Canadian.
Wow,
that is incredible.
And then I'm realizing I have to get back to Iceland, because that was just getting me back to Winnipeg. And then I started looking at airfare to Iceland, and it was going to cost $1,600 for a one way ticket to Iceland.
From more than half. Wow.
Oh gosh. And speaking of other luck, talk about the story of you getting into Istanbul. I remember tracking that one on Facebook.
I left a couple of days before that big earthquake, but everybody thought I was still in Istanbul.
I was one of those as well. I remember because I saw that you had landed, and then they had said the big earthquake had happened. I was like, I think Ken just landed there the other day. But yeah, you had snuck out.
I was only there for a couple of days, so you know, thank goodness. And I don't think Istanbul was really affected at all. It was more east and stuff.
Mm. Oh, fair enough.
What was one surprising experience you had on that trip in all the many countries you visited? Something that you didn't expect?
Well, I had a friend who set up, did you guys see the flyover Iceland at all? Did you?
Oh, yeah, yep.
Yep.
I had a friend from Taiwan who set that up.
Hmm.
Like, it's a Canadian company.
Oh, I see.
It's a Taiwanese company that sets it up, or, you know, kind of provides the equipment and stuff. And so I said, well, I'm going to come to Taiwan, and he was going to be there. And I said, you know, how long should I stay? And he says, well, we'll do a tour of Taiwan. And so that's fine. And I kind of left it up to him, and he made arrangements for this tour, and it was a Disney tour. They were all the trains were it was a comfortable train ride and stuff, though. Mm. But we get on the train, on this Disney tour train.
Oh, really?
And we went around the country. Mm. And it was just so weird being in a Disney train car.
Uh-huh.
And they kept feeding us, and we were always eating and stuff. But I was the only foreigner there. there was a lot of people from other places, and I was the only one that they had to speak English with. You know, because like the Taiwanese, they speak like the Mandarin or, you know, the Chinese and stuff. So there was maybe some tourists from China, but mainly just tourists from, and it was kind of a more family thing. Mm-hmm. But it was still quite an experience, and I thought my friend would kind of translate a little bit more for me. It was all in Chinese, you know, Taiwanese, and mm-hmm. but it was still some beautiful scenery and stuff. Mm. And mm. that's similar to when I went to a wedding in Ethiopia.
Ah, yes.
And it was kind of a family thing, and I got a good deal there too. I was going to go and. Or he invited me to his wedding. It's a coworker of mine at the school, and I said, well, I couldn't go because I had a tour booked, and then the tour canceled on me. So I looked it up, and I went to Paris, Cairo, and Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, Well, I went kind of one way there, and then I stopped in Cairo on the way back and stopped in Paris on the way back. So I had three trips in one, and it cost me just over $1,000 for the airport. And I wouldn't have done it if it had cost me $5,000 or whatever. Uh-huh. So I went to this guy's wedding, and it was like a five-day party, or, you know, kind of, and no real drinking and stuff. It was just all kinds of food and all. And we went to a big reception. It was probably about 250 people there in this big, you know, reception hall. I was the tallest, the fattest, and the only white person there. Yeah, everybody else was black or, you know, kind of darker. And so I kind of stood out a little bit. But it was...
A Viking in foreign lands.
I don't regret it. And then we had, you know, fun. They showed me around quite a bit. And coming back, I stayed in Cairo. And that was just before there was some massive riots and stuff in Cairo. And I rented a room on a houseboat on the Nile.
Oh, cool.
And that was awesome. And right downtown. And so I kind of, you know, stayed away from the riots and stuff. But and then I spent a couple of days in Paris. Wow. On the way back too. So
quite a well-rounded trip. And there's lots of deals to be had out there in the world if you're flexible and willing to.
Yeah, well, but things aren't very flexible now. I was looking because now WestJet's going to be flying and Air Canada's going to be flying. So I thought that there'd be maybe some deals. But I was looking at going back to Gimli or Winnipeg for a festival, and it's going to cost $1,500 or something return. And it's for all.
Yeah, I don't know how I lucked out, but I got the first return flight from Reykjavik, WestJet to Calgary on their new flight. I got it for $250, just a one-way trip back to Calgary, which is great for me because that's where I live. So it's a direct flight home. And I don't know how I got that good of a price, but it was also, of course, just the one-way. But then the flight going to Iceland with Iceland Air was, you know, almost quadruple that. So...
Yeah, I was going to say, I booked mine about a year out. I booked it last August for this coming July, and it was $1,000 round trip.
That Iceland Air?
With Iceland Air through Toronto, yeah. I figured I was nostalgic for the Iceland Air. I wanted to go back on what felt good like home.
When are you coming back, Jack?
April 22nd to May 16th. So in just over a month here now.
Awesome. But I feel like this is probably a pretty good spot to tie a bow on it, folks. Kent, thank you so much for being flexible with us today. And I know it's a little bit later there in Iceland now, but thanks again for just...
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the podcast. For some reason, our recording kind of cut short there. But for the next couple of minutes, Owen and I just kind of rambled on a little bit about daylight savings time. And as we had just gone through the time change before recording this with Kent. Kent, of course, was in Iceland when we recorded this episode. So Iceland is one of those smart places in the world that doesn't do daylight savings time or has to deal with any sort of time changes. So anyways, I hope you all found this podcast episode insightful. We had a little bit of a break starting in 2024, a break of recording podcast episodes, but we have a lot more interviews lined up with interesting Western Icelanders such as Kent, but then also lots of other people relating to all things Iceland. So thank you for tuning in. Be sure to check out the Icelandic Roots website. And if you are not familiar with the genealogy database, as we referenced here in the podcast, if you're of Icelandic ancestry, that is the number one resource that you need to have access to. If you are not of Icelandic ancestry, just interested in the culture and all of these cool bits and pieces, the tourism, the history, everything, the nature, all of the Icelandic stuff, we got so many resources on the Icelandic Roots website. Articles on different aspects of Icelandic history and modern-day Iceland that you cannot find anywhere else. Icelandic Roots is really the number one repository for these different things. So check out the website, do become a member if you're interested, and of course, subscribe to the podcast and stay tuned for more interviews. Sjáumst, takk fyrir.